From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 8th day of June 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Eric Snodgrass will be here from Agribolt to take a detailed look at the agricultural weather forecast across the Corn Belt. Eric says there'll be some rain, although he's wondering just exactly how things are setting up. As it looks further out, we could have some dry conditions, though sea surface temperatures are saying something different at this point. You'll have to listen to understand it all, but it's worthwhile, so stay with us for that. And we'll take a look at the agricultural news for the day as well on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, of course, you're listening to the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. Mike Zuzulo is now here from Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Is it hot and muggy there?
It has gotten a lot more muggy this week, Todd, and we have missed all the rain. So the 14-day precip maps versus normal are starting to get pretty significant across U.S. 36 and 72 and 74. And I wrote on my blog, on my website last night, and made the case based upon my conversations with the primary weather consultant and some of the other stuff I've been looking at, that I get the feeling that this weekend and early next week is either going to be the beginning or the ending of the weather market this year. And I say that specifically because of the crop conditions being so high in the USDA's numbers, yet we have such a vulnerable central Corn Belt crop going into a really key time period. I would say this weekend is probably just as important as a traditional July 4th weekend. And at the end of the day, it could, you know, make the difference between having a 170 plus yield nationally or a sub 170 yield nationally. So this will work into what we deal with all the fundamentals next week.
Yeah, the fundamentals have been overshadowing the weather at this time of year. And while it's a little early, the crop has gotten off to a really good start, and it's early too. So the weather, I mean the weather market started a little early. But these fundamentals, you've got the WASDE report, which seems like not that big a deal at the moment, other than we need to know what that Brazil number looks like. And I'll ask you about that, or you can tell me. And then, of course, we have President in North Korea on the 12th, and we have the tariffs potentially going into effect on the 15th, and the G7 meeting is happening right now in Canada. It's just all kinds of things that have been pushing the marketplace around. Where do you want to start?
Well, I think the best place to start is probably what have we probably factored in and what haven't we probably factored in. I think you can see by the price action this week, for the week, the wheat's going to close exactly steady on the week in the soft red complex. And after dropping sharply on Monday, we saw the crop conditions come out. We saw the hard red wheat yield reports start to come out in Oklahoma before some midweek rains hit the Oklahoma-Kansas border. And wheat started to jump back and gain back its losses and finished even. The real hit was in the soybeans. And I think there's two things here. One is, maybe three. One is the trade, I think, overdid it last week by taking beans ahead of corn on the spread, betting on the come for China and the demand side. They had to take that out this week, and I think that was extra strong in the weekly export sales for meal and for soybeans. It was just a bad demand week overall in the soy complex. Then you had to deal with the situation that the private forecasters are starting to bump up the Brazilian forecast for soybean production. And even Argentina is a question mark in beans versus corn. So going into the report, I think the trade played it pretty wisely. They took the beans down 5%. They kept the corn playing in between the wheat and the beans. And I think they did factor in some of the report numbers, with that being, if we have negative trade news, if we continue to have negative demand prospects because of this trade news, and we get the rains that the American model is suggesting, what's the most likely one to be hit the hardest in price for the report? And I think it is the soybeans. And so now, going into today's close and going into the first of next week, not including whatever weather premium we have to put back in, my elasticity model would say lead month corn at around 375, the trade's back to a 1.92 billion bushel carryover for lead month futures, beans at 970. we're trading about a 420 to 430 million bushel carryover going into the report. And that those aren't too far from where the trade is, especially for the 2017 carryover numbers.
Yeah, so those WASDE numbers will come out on next week. I think that's Tuesday, right? Yeah, should be Tuesday. And when we see them, I take it the first thing you'll look at is what that Brazilian number looks like, and then, or maybe the second, and what the ending stocks are for the 2018-19 crop.
Yeah, both domestically and globally. What I'm going to be looking at, since both Nova Beans and Deese Corn are closed down below their 200-day moving averages, and have taken away all their run up since January, while the wheat has not, what I'll be looking at is, okay, how much more downside do we have supply demand wise? In other words, do we build the world stocks of wheat enough to overshadow the potential, I think, a likelihood of a corn ending stocks number going down globally? Or do we have a situation where the beans remain the leader to the downside because we stay elevated in an 18-19 ending stocks number around 86, 88 million metric tons? Trade estimates, average guess is 86.7, almost the exact as May. I'm a bit higher than that at 88 million on a little bit less demand and a little bit more Brazil production than what USDA is carrying right now. So that'll be the big thing to me, is do the beans remain the leader to the downside? And if that's the case, we've got a gap in the soybeans from January at around 943 and three quarters. Would not shock me a bit to see the USDA report or the weather after the weekend push us down sharply, fill that gap, and then we start all over again.
That's a long ways down, at least for many people as they look at beans. Do we need to take any protection, in your opinion, or is it too late for that?
Yeah, I don't think you can at this point. I mean, I'm hedged up enough. I feel pretty good about it. I've actually got more desire to flock in feed needs. I recommended today to livestock producers of hogs, cattle, and chickens to go ahead and lock in corn needs through September 1. I'll be looking at meal next week, actually, Todd, because we're starting to get down to that 350 level for the August meal. So unless I see something really negative that we haven't priced in from the report, because like you said, I do think that the weather is starting to be factored in some as far as ignoring it, you know, in terms of the missed rains in the central corn belt. I'll probably be looking at feed hedges more than I would be adding to the producer hedges, because we're getting closer and closer to undervalue levels, not overvalue levels.
So at this point, hedging your bets to some extent, but still thinking that there's a weather market to come for an opportunity, I take it, and that going ahead and making sure that those who have input needs for corn, bean meal, such, get something done.
Yeah, you know, what we have right now, generally speaking, especially along the rivers, is a pretty poor futures market and a pretty poor basis, and that's really ideal for the livestock person. So something will probably have to give and go against him one way or the other in one of those two avenues. And, you know, we used to say buy low, sell high. I like to say buy profit, sell profit, in terms of what you do in the hedging side.
Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate you being with us, and we'll talk with you in 1 week.
And make sure you have the Maalox next to you next week, Todd.
Okay, I will. Hey, thanks so much. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, the Senate Ag Committee has finally set a date to act on its version of the Farm Bill, as House leaders struggle to clear a political path to reconsider the defeated House version. Senate Ag will consider a 2018 Senate Farm Bill next Wednesday, starting at 9:30 a.m. Eastern, just a few months before the current law expires. Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Pat Roberts and Ranking Democrat Debbie Stabenow announced the business meeting in a joint press conference, citing their efforts to craft a bipartisan bill to provide much-needed certainty for agriculture and rural America. But formal Senate action comes more than 6 months late from when ag lawmakers hoped to finish a farm bill, and as House leaders struggle to get their defeated bill back up for a floor vote later this month. But the one thing certain now is the Senate bill needs Democratic votes to reach a 60-vote Senate threshold, so it will not contain the tougher snap work and training requirements that help sideline the House bill. Farm Bureau's Andrew Walmsley, meantime, expects more in common on farm programs.
I don't think we'll see too much disparity between, you know, the commodity title and crop insurance. I'm sure there'll be some tweaks around the edges to try to improve those programs. I think the Senate will focus maybe on some improvements to ARC and similarly to the House bill on dairy. You know, we'll know the conservation titles will be different between the two chambers.
Senate ag staffers are expected to brief leaders sometime today. Well, from the Farm Bill, let's move to trade, where House Ways and Means members left their Thursday meeting with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer pretty discouraged, quotes Politico, about the administration's trade moves. In fact, they're a little worried that the administration doesn't really have an approach at all. "We left there, I think, feeling there's just no clear strategy," said Representative Sandy Levin, a Democrat of Michigan. "What's the end game?" That was the first question that was asked. Among the concerns raised by the Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee were the continued business uncertainty resulting from the drawn-out negotiations of NAFTA. For their part, Republicans on the committee have urged the administration to push for a strong and modern NAFTA with binding dispute settlement, including investor-state dispute settlement, and without the uncertainty created by an automatic sunset. The lawmaker said Lighthizer did not give any timeline for conclusion of the talks. We'll stay with trade, where the U.S. government has struck a deal with Chinese telecommunications company ZTE. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said Thursday, resolving one of the major demands for the Chinese government amid ongoing trade talks. But Ross also said that China had no plans to improve the situation for U.S. exporters in exchange for the Trump administration's decision to lift the ban that prevented U.S. firms from doing business with ZTE. And finally today, I'm sure you've heard by now, but Bayer successfully completed the acquisition of Monsanto yesterday, retiring the Monsanto name. Acquired products by Bayer will retain brand names and become part of Bayer's portfolio. However, company officials say making the change will take some time. Shares in the U.S. company will no longer be traded on the New York Stock Exchange, with Bayer now the sole owner of Monsanto. Monsanto shareholders are being paid $128 per share. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. Hey, Eric, thanks so much. Let's take a look at the weather forecast. What do you see?
Well, Todd, I think big picture is where we need to start. You see, April was the second coldest April on record for us here in the state of Illinois. And then things really made a pretty dramatic shift into May. In fact, once May, all the data was finally tallied, turns out May was our warmest May on record. And as a consequence, we are about 250, some locations, 300 growing degree day units ahead of average. And that, plus the rain we've had throughout the state of Illinois and nearby states, has made our corn crop look fantastic. Now, that is not to say there aren't dry patches. In fact, I'm looking right now at a map that shows us the last 30 days of precipitation anomalies. And you can find pockets in Illinois, pockets in Indiana, parts of Missouri, parts of Iowa that are pretty dry. And as a consequence, we just had our latest drought monitor update that came out just the other day. We had the first stage of drought through parts of Illinois. But overall, things have started off pretty darn well. So this is what I want to get into. You see, when we look at those maps that kind of show us how weather, you know, in the previous month compared to average, here's the two regions I want to key in on. The southern region. So now we're talking about the states of like Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, you know, maybe into Mississippi a little bit and parts of Oklahoma. Okay, that region, it had their eighth driest May on record. Whereas, move a little east of there, go over to the southeast. So think about Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, you know, that those states, they have their third wettest. So I went out and I grabbed the top 10 driest years in the southern region, and I found the top 10 wettest years in the southeastern region because they ranked pretty high this year. And I wanted to see, well, what happened in the following June, July, and Augusts of those top 10 driest years for the southern region and top 10 wettest regions for the southeast. Okay, so we're basically doing what we call an analog forecast. And the picture's pretty clear. In those years, there was a lot of heat in the central United States. And those years were also quite dry in the central U.S. And why I bring this up is because, you know, this being the end of the first week of June, we saw our brand new long-range model updates from the European model, from the national model, a multi-model ensemble, which is a bunch of models run in the U.S. and Canada. We even have our new Japanese models in. And they're all kind of following suit. And what are they saying? Well, they're saying that for June, July, August, really July and August, that there is a threat for some heat in the Central Plains, like we've been seeing in May, and also dry risks. Now, certainly in the short term, we're not seeing this. There's been a whole lot of thunderstorm activity, and that is always the game changer. Why I'm telling you this is just about the overall risk picture. So I think what we need to be thinking about here is that our long-range guidance at this point is hinting toward the possibility of some hotter and some drier risks as we move forward. And there's some support for that, certainly across the North American continent. Now, what's not in alignment are sea surface temperatures, and they're a good predictor. We are not in the correct kind of configuration with sea surface temperatures to bring in a hot and dry summer for the Great Lakes states. But we do have these other factors we must think about. So as we just keep talking every week and we go into these longer range discussions, I'll just keep you updated on how things are evolving. Now, remember, this is just an idea, and it's just something I want to have people listen to because it's just a word of caution. Okay, here's the thing of the next 15 days or so. We are going to be under a ridge for quite some time. This will at least be through the next 7 to 10 days. We'll be under this decent ridge. So that means the Gulf of Mexico is going to be wide open. We're going to have this transport of moisture to the north, and that means every day there's the risk for thunderstorms. Now, thunderstorms are hyperlocal events, which means we have to forecast them on a day-to-day basis. But with northwest flow aloft and abundant moisture, there will be squall lines, there will be supercells, there will be regions that get thunderstorms. But see, when this happens, this doesn't necessarily cure drought. I mean, I'm looking again at that map. I can see that like near Decatur, Illinois, central Indiana, we got some regions in here that are having some of their driest, you know, early spring time periods on record. So it's going to be a factor of, are the ridge riders going to set up to where we get, you know, a nice good drink across a big section of the Corn Belt with a decently sized squall line? Or are we going to be doing this hit or miss game for quite some time now? But here's the bigger picture I think we need to think about for middle of June. You see, as things progress and we get toward, you know, the 14th, 15th, 16th, our long-range models now for several days have been trying to push that ridge west, bringing in some heat to the Pacific Northwest, which has actually been, relatively cool recently. So if that happens and that ridge slides to the west, we're talking about that third week of June, possibly cooling down a little bit, not cold, but just simply cooling down. And that will continue to make our crops look fantastic. This is interesting because it's quite a bit different from last year. Remember, June last year, for pretty much the whole month, came in really, really hot. And then things kind of looked great. The second half of July and August was absolutely incredible. So we have a different picture than what we had last year. And I think it's important that we just kind of keep a very close eye on these bigger features. So these long-range models, yeah, they're hinting toward the potential for some hotter and drier conditions. In the near term, it's going to be all about ridge riding thunderstorms and that upper level ridge shifting to the west with time. So a lot to contend with. And I think, you know, if we just talk about how the markets are kind of pushed at times by the weather, I think we're in for some volatile time period here with how that's going to work out.
Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILL.org.